Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for March 24th, 2022, in the ongoing series of my shows dedicated to discoveries that I made throughout my career. And this month, March, I'm concentrating on what I call the Cornell years. And the two academic years, 1979 fall semester to spring semester 1981, in which there was just an absolute avalanche of discoveries that I made with pre-existing theoretical work that I had in place, data coming in from all over the solar system, and dealing with the sun, all kinds of things falling into place there, and then just my ability to assimilate all of this and then produce the theoretical work, which, by the way, is a complete rewriting, literally, of every aspect of the theoretical nature of the universe, of the solar system, the fusion, the way the sun works, the fact that Jupiter and Saturn are small stars, and the, of course, the plasma discharge comet model, which is what a lot of people point to. But that's just one aspect of all of this, because the planets are acting as comets. The moons of the planets are acting as comets. The objects in the capacitors of Jupiter and Saturn, which are proton wind capacitors, are acting as comets. And so the whole situation is that the standard theories that existed just did not even come close to explaining what you see. Okay, so what I'm going to do tonight is the 300-page book that I had written. Last week and last couple weeks, I talked about the Galaxy paper, the first peer-reviewed published paper. Then last week, I also talked about the Saturn Sweeper Moon paper. Those are the initial published work during the Cornell years. And then the 300-page book, which became the basis for the three-part comet paper, which you can read. It's in the appendix of my Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes book. In the appendix, you will find these papers reprinted. And so I'm going to go through that tonight. And this would be, this show, particular show right now, is the core science. This is where I break down the solar system, the solar wind, in all the different aspects of what happens. What are the characteristics of a comet? I predict X-rays to the sunward side of comets, something that would be discovered in 1996 by accident by NASA. But I predicted that. I also will point out the use of the term electric universe, which is a term I coined and was using for decades until it got absconded with by other... anyway, I won't go into that here. But I will show you where the term electric universe comes from and why it describes what exactly we're looking at here. And then I'll talk also about some Nobel Prize issues, but I'm going to start with that. Let's first take a look at some of the Nobel Prize. But first, I want to go back to Isaac Newton. And here's a guy back in the Middle Ages who just discovered so many things. His main credits, if you look up and say, what did Isaac Newton discover, and you did a computer search, they would say universal gravity, universal gravitational law. They would talk about the splitting of white light into its component colors using a prism, and then calculus. These are all major discoveries, but each one of these has many, many sub-discoveries. Many sub-discoveries, and then there's other things that don't even make it into the top 10 list, which are major discoveries. For example, Newton did some experiments, and he found out that the temperature of the sun, the amount of energy coming off of the sun, was not commensurate with a chemical fire, because here you could imagine the sun is this glowing ball up in the sky. They're just beginning to understand a few things about it. So what does Newton do? He does an experiment capturing the energy from the sun in a certain area and then heats up a vial of material and determines that the amount of energy coming in that small little area, if you multiply it by that area and integrate it, so to speak, over the entire surface surrounding, three-dimensional surface that would be surrounding the sun, that the sun is putting out a lot more energy than if you had, say, a big pile of wood on the sun and that wood pile was burning. You could not get that amount of energy out of a chemical fire. So Newton knew. He didn't know the process. It took until Einstein and actually Hans Bethe to understand the physical process. Einstein, with his E equals mc squared equation that comes out of special relativity. But Newton already knew in the Middle Ages that the sun had some kind of process that exceeded chemical reactions. Wow. I mean, this guy was all over the place. And so it would be interesting if there were a Nobel Prize in the days of Isaac Newton. What would he be given a Nobel Prize for? Or a mathematical prize, like, say, the Field Prize for mathematicians under the age of 40 who have made great discoveries. Well, it would have been Newton again. I mean, he was all over the place. And in every category, like I said, he would have had subcategories. Okay, so let's take the Nobel Prizes. Let's go back to the Curies, who discovered the properties of radioactive materials. And it was a husband-wife pair. Let's talk about Albert Einstein. You know, when people talk about Einstein, they talk about relativity, special relativity, general relativity, which, by the way, Einstein disagreed with, if you look at the correct history. But he gets a Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect. A couple-page paper, just a small analysis, but it was instrumental in understanding quantum physics. And then Hans Bethe, who I communicated with directly. I used to go up to Hans' office when he was at Cornell, when I was at Cornell, and he was a resident there. And in 1967, finally, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for his excellent work on the what they call the chemical chains in nuclear, in the sun, in the production of heavier elements through fusion, and how the heavier elements in the sun were built up. But also he was on the Manhattan Project, and he was friends with Albert Einstein. When I talked to him, he would talk about Albert, and that was the way he referred to Albert Einstein, by his first name. But they, of course, came over on the same time frame, Einstein ending up at Princeton, Hans Bethe at Cornell. And then what's interesting, too, is the Curies, Marie Curie, 1903, was her physics prize dealing with radiation, but then in 1911 was awarded the chemistry Nobel Prize, also dealing with radiation, etc. Okay, so the point being is that if you look at the history of major discoveries, they were things that were very instrumental at the time, things that changed the way people saw things, opened up a new door, opened up, turned that lock and opened up the door that nobody had been able to see before. And so those are the main things that were awarded Nobel Prize. Or how about Bohr atom, the year after Einstein, 1921, photoelectric effect, Niels Bohr, 1922, talking about the Bohr atom and the energy levels, the quantum energy levels in an atom. Very important work, which led up to the Schrödinger equation and a more detailed analysis, wave equations, etc., which were abstract ways of looking at energy levels. Okay, now I wanted to go back a little bit. I was talking about Isaac Newton before. Another thing that he discovered along with universal gravity was the fact that when things were set into motion, they would continue in motion until there was an opposing force. And he understood what friction was, that friction was a force. Aristotle and Aristotelian physics had been taught for thousands of years up until Newton. And Newton came along and said, no, that's wrong. That the Aristotle taught that things would naturally come to rest if left on their own. And Newton said, no, it's coming to rest because of friction, and friction is an actual force. So that's another one of those little understandings that made understanding, say, the motion of the planets, etc., really, you know, a fundamental observation that had overturned thinking that had been in existence for thousands of years. And then along at the same time was Kepler and Johann Kepler and also Halley. And they came to the discovery that comets were not in the atmosphere. That's what Aristotelian physics had taught, that comets were up in the atmosphere. It was fire burning in the atmosphere, when in reality, Kepler and Halley showed that, no, they're out there. They're out in outer space amongst the planets, and they have regular periods. And so the discovery of Halley's Comet, then they went back through history and discovered that every 71 years, periodically, this comet would come through the solar system and be observable. And it happened during famous battles. It happened on the Boyle tapestry, this famous tapestry that came out of the Middle Ages from England, etc. And so these are discoveries that were monumental for the time. Now we look at them as like just regular common knowledge. But I'm going to quickly read some more Nobel Prizes here, because these are instrumental, because when I came along doing my work at Cornell, I overturned theories that had been, in some cases, just recently established or so. How about the 1978 Penzias and Wilson discovery of microwave background radiation, which had been predicted by the Big Bang, by the expanding universe, and so that was taking hold. So they made a good discovery, they made the measurement, but for the wrong theory. And so once these things get in place, wow, is it tough to get them out of the minds of the theorists, and especially when a Nobel Prize is given. Or how about the 2002 Giacconi discovery of sources of cosmic X-rays? And once again, the discovery is a physical discovery, but the theoretical reasons being incorrect. Then 2011, the expansion of the universe using distant supernovae star systems. And there again, the interpretation that this is the expansion of the universe, but I had long since proven that this redshift that they're looking at is not due to motion of this thing moving away from us, but because of the light leaving the non-uniform electric field around these fusion-based objects. And so how about the 2014? This is something else that is a practical discovery, and I'm making note of it here because there's a practical side of the 2014 Nobel Prize, which is the discovery of light-emitting diodes. Like right now, the amount of energy in the world being saved because of this discovery is monumental. One-third of the electricity developed in the world is for lighting. Can you imagine that? It's with the old incandescent light bulbs. And this invention drops that by a factor of 10. So they gave a Nobel Prize, and deservedly so, for the discovery of light-emitting diodes. And then just one more, the 2017 LIGO detector, gravitational wave detection, Nobel Prize. Once again, very good work experimentally, but not truly understanding the physical part of the gravitational wave. What's causing them? Where are they coming from? And then the 2006 Nobel Prize for the asymmetrical microwave background radiation, the differences in the microwave background radiation, because when they first discovered it, the prediction was that it should be absolutely even and 360 degrees all around. And then when they measured it with the COBE satellite, they said, whoa, there's pockets, there's this, and regions where it's intense. And so they had to come up with a theory. And that's where the 2006 Nobel Prize came in. But once again, instead of taking the original theory and saying, hey, there's something wrong here, they came along and had to put a Band-Aid. So the 2006 Nobel Prize is nothing more than a Band-Aid for the incorrect theoretical work that came in the 1978 Nobel Prize. Okay, why am I reading all this once again? It's because it's important to note these and the timing of these, but also that some of them are wrong. Some of these Nobel Prizes have incorrect portions to them, etc. Just like Einstein's general relativity is really not Einstein's, it's really Eddington's general relativity, which is really completely full of holes and has major problems when it comes to the energy analogy or the principle of equivalence. The general relativity has many good aspects, the warp space-time model with tensor analysis, etc. But when it comes to bending of light around gravitational objects, that's where it breaks down. The whole idea of a black hole is simply not true because of the warp space-time analysis and the idea of light being drawn into a black hole. When people see X-rays at the so-called event horizon, what they're seeing are electrically induced X-rays, Bremsstrahlung X-rays, surrounding an electrically charged object, especially quasars, etc. And what they call black holes are really not. They are very intense non-uniform electric fields around fusion-based objects, like at the center of our galaxy. So it's not a black hole. There's other things going on there that create the illusion of an event boundary. Okay. Why did I do this? Because I wanted you to put all of this in perspective, because when I start laying out the correct theoretical structure for the universe, for the way the sun works, the non-uniform electric field created by the abundance of protons in the solar wind, and the way you say that, the correct way of saying is an excess current of protons, because current is something that's very subtle. To have current, you have a charge that's moving and at a certain velocity. So there's two aspects of current. It's the amount of charge and it's the relative velocity of that charge. You need the two things together to be current, electrical current, moving charged particles. And so by an excess current of protons in a solar wind, you can have the same number of protons as electrons. But if the protons are moving faster, then you have an excess current of protons. And that's what I'm talking about here. And the mechanism, I go through the mechanism also. This is one of the things I had to discover at Cornell. Because when I went there, I knew that comets were charged. I knew that they were negatively charged. I knew the sun was negatively charged. But the entire picture of how this came about was unclear, because in what is known as Chapman physics, the electrical nature of the solar system simply doesn't exist. And there are very good reasons for believing this. Because if you have a charged particle in outer space, it will become neutralized in a New York second, because the charge distribution in a plasma is free. It's free to move and it's free to surround that charged object and neutralize it, and this happens very quickly. But what they didn't count on, what they did not count on, was the fact that the sun fusion engine was up in the atmosphere, number one. That's one of the major discoveries that I made, is that the fusion was not in the core, was up in the atmosphere. And second of all, that the protons were accelerated because of the corona. And what's the corona? The corona is the electron, the field of electrons, or I shouldn't say field because you could confuse it with electric field, but the sea of electrons at relativistic speeds around orbit around the sun. And why are they in orbit around the sun? The same reason you have very high energy particles in orbit around the Earth in the Van Allen belts. They're trapped in the magnetic field of the sun, so they're spinning around the sun. Electrons in one belt, the protons and other ions in another series of belts around the sun, but the electrons are the primary charge that are surrounding the sun. And when the protons come out from the fusion reactions, they are accelerated towards the screen of electrons. The protons come out, and they, as they approach, because they're accelerating, the electrons there's like a hole that breaks in the corona, and the proton streams come shooting through and then accelerated out to the outer edge of the solar system. The other thing that happens here is like the inside of a Van de Graaff accelerator. What happens with a Van de Graaff, and you have the big round ball at the top, you see these in high school laboratories. What's going on is you're taking electrons on a rubber belt, bringing them up and dropping them off on a series like of electrical teeth that ride along that belt. And what happens? The electrons come up into this circuit, and they flow outwards. Why do they flow outwards? Because they're repelling each other, just like the protons in the solar wind are repelling the sea of protons. And so that causes them to move out relatively steadily all the way out beyond the orbit of Pluto. In fact, much beyond the orbit of Pluto. If you look in my original papers, which were published in the early 1980s, I talk about the end of the solar wind being around the planet Jupiter, which at the time was where it was believed to be. But as the Voyager and the Pioneer spacecraft went out farther and farther, they said, hey, the solar wind is still out here. So that was a measurement that was not, that nobody had the ability to calculate that. And nobody understood why the solar wind was even there. So anyway, the solar wind is expanding because it's just like the inside of a Van de Graaff housing where the similarly charged particles are expanding because they're repelling each other. Okay, and that's why you can keep building up charge and building up charge. And that's the same situation with the solar capacitor. It'll keep building up charge and building up charge. And the positive part of this capacitor is the nebular ion cloud, which surrounds the sun. And you can see these around other stars. I have a picture in some of my original publications of what is known as the Eskimo Nebula. And you can see the planets forming in the outer nebula. You can see them forming from big comets. And so that would be the equivalent of our Kuiper Belt. Scientists today cannot tell you where all of these thousands of planets are coming from out in that region known as the Kuiper Belt, of which Pluto is a part. Pluto is on the inner edge of that. Pluto is a Kuiper Belt object. And that's why they demoted it from being a planet, because they had two options. They could either say Pluto's a planet, and they'd have to admit that all of these thousands of other objects out there are planets, and they didn't want to do that. And so they didn't want to upset the old nine planets apple cart. So what they did is they said, well, we'll just remove Pluto from being a planet. We'll demote it from being a planet and be done with it. Yeah. So anyway, and this goes into the terminology of Planet X, because Pluto was Planet 9. And so now they have about another 1,000 candidates for Planet X, which was the 10th planet, X being the Roman numeral 10. So anyway, there were political reasons why they had to demote Pluto from the 9th planet. Now they were looking for Planet 9. A little bit of funny business there. Okay, so at any rate, now I'm going to go into the discoveries of this time period, 1979 to 81. And like I say, you've already seen the galaxy paper. That's an intro to kind of the shoe in the door to show why you needed twin stars, and that the twin stars developed the solar system, the comet capture process in the development of solar system. In fact, that was the name of my book, is The Origin of the Planets, Comet Capture Processes in the Formation of Solar Systems. And as I said before, can you imagine the horror, absolute horror, in the astronomy department at Cornell when they started seeing my work coming out with these kind of names on it after they had completely buried, literally, Velikovsky. And of course, like I said, I didn't know who Velikovsky was. I didn't know the hornet's nest that I was walking into there. But, okay, so let me go through this series of discoveries. They said the reason I went through this litany of Nobel Prizes was to show you that I have probably 10 to 15 certainly Nobel Prize winning discoveries, and then actually a lot more minor discoveries that were attached to these. Okay, so here we go. This is a summary. This is not 100% But this is covering the major topics. And also, just want to mention that when Sagan did his Cosmos series, there was something else very subtle in the background, and that is atheist science, that they had to account for all of what science sees, everything that it witnesses, and without a divine creator, without a master planner, that all of this that you see was just at random. It just happened. It started with a big bang, and one day evolution started, and, you know, a couple billion years later, here's people walking around. Okay, so anyway, starting with the sun, dealing with the comet nature of the sun, and this is very fundamental because the sun does not have enough atmosphere. Even in the core, there's not enough core material for it to burn for 4.5 billion years, as they're stating as the age of the solar system. So something else is going on. So the sun had to accumulate matter and has to, on an ongoing basis, accumulate matter. And how does it do this? Well, it's acting as a comet also. It's acting as a comet in the galactic wind. There's a proton wind that's coming out of the galaxy nucleus. Just, it's a fusion-based object also. There's some other higher-order processes there. But the sun, therefore, has a sunward spike that goes into the direction of the outflowing wind. And now the outflowing wind is where we are, is not coming directly from the direction of the nucleus of the galaxy. It swerves out, just as the sun, our own sun's solar wind, swerves. Yeah, but at any rate, when I worked with the Russian scientists later in my career in the mid-1990s, this would be a full 15 years after my Cornell years, they verified that the sun had variable output, and this was based on a variable collection of hydrogen as we move through intergalactic space. So that's a main one. So the sun has all the characteristics of a comet. And by the way, that's also where my work dealing with electric propulsion systems comes from, something that I coined the term electric highways to the stars. And you can see a video of me in the early 2000s at the UFO Congress giving a discussion of that, and that I had carried that term also with me in a lot of private meetings. In fact, as soon as I was out of Cornell, I went back for a little respite, rested up. I'll be talking about that in April, those years. But I was off in Los Angeles in the early 1980s working on venture capital for my electromagnetic propulsion systems. Okay, so the atmosphere of the sun is the fusion fire, and it's ignited by what is called the pinch effect. The pinch effect is when electrical discharges occur. And as the currents, if you've ever seen lightning, it's not a straight line, it's like jagged. And in those bends, the magnetic fields get high enough to pinch the hydrogen, the deuterium, etc., in the sun, and the heavier elements also, which are building up even heavier elements. But it's the pinch effect which kicks off the fusion reaction. So it's literally a fusion fire. It's an electrical fire with hydrogen as the source. And as I said, it needs an ongoing supply of hydrogen, and that comes into the sun from the sun's basically comet tail. And the other thing is that comes into play when you start looking at the light curves of stars in the galaxy, and it is not explained at all by missing mass or dark matter, or dark energy. It's not explained at all. Even if those things existed, they still don't explain the true light curves that you see. They're totally backwards from a 1 over the square root of R curve that would be the normal velocity curve of objects that were in circular orbits around the galactic nucleus. Okay, so anyway, for those of you who are a little bit, those of you who are not physicists, what that means is that you need another explanation for the light curves, the red and blue shift light curves, dealing with the velocity of stars around the galactic nucleus. Okay, the zodiacal disk is a disk that's like a Saturn-like disk around the sun. And that comes from the fact that there's a differential process like a centrifuge. And it's not really a centrifuge. A centrifuge is you take some, for example, blood is a good example, and you put it into a test tube and you spin it, and the denser material goes to the far end of the test tube, and the lighter, less dense materials remain closer to the center. And so it's there's a process like this in the solar wind that is blowing out, and the lighter particles get blown out farther away from the sun, and the heavier ones remain near the sun. So you have a lot of iron near the sun. You have, in fact, the zodiacal disk is made up of iron, whereas at Saturn, the Saturnian disk is made up of water. And the Jupiter disk is made up of sulfur dioxide. So you have sulfur dioxide in the region of Jupiter, and you have water out in the region of Saturn, and then you get out to the Neptune, Uranus, Pluto, and you have the very lighter compounds, the nitrogen-hydrogen compounds, which are lighter. And so at any rate, there's this differential in the cleansing, so to speak, in the solar wind. And that's what the source of comet material is. And Earth happens to set in a water zone. So does Mars. So does Venus. By the way, Venus is on the inner edge of that. And so Venus has a high concentration of carbon dioxide. Mercury, which spent a good deal of time closer to the sun, has a higher content of iron. And then Earth also has a higher content of iron because apparently in its early stages, as a large comet developing as a planet, it spent a good deal of time, most probably in a highly elliptical orbit, coming close to the sun and building up a good deal of iron. And so anyway, that's important. That's a characteristic of the zodiacal disk and the understanding that this differential process in the solar wind. The excess current of protons in the solar wind, this is something, a major, major discovery that I made, because when I got to Cornell, I knew that comets were negatively charged, the region around them, and I didn't know how this happened exactly. I was looking for the process, and then it became apparent with the data from Pioneer at Saturn, with the Voyagers at Saturn, especially Saturn, which is more active than Jupiter, and then the report that came in from the data that Voyager 1 had detected proton wind coming up off of Jupiter. And that solidified it for me, that the proton-supported winds, the fusion-based winds that are coming off the fusion objects like Jupiter. Now, here's the other thing. The core fusion bottle of the sun says that you need all of this mass of the sun bearing down on that central core, which they say is hydrogen, and to give it enough pressure to kick off the, allegedly, to kick off the nuclear fusion reaction. But you don't have that at Jupiter, and you certainly don't have it at Saturn. You don't have enough mass on there to kick off this central core fusion. And so it was just very clear that the fusion was up in the atmosphere and going back to the sun, that, yes, the atmosphere of the sun was where the fusion was occurring. Very clearly not enough atmosphere there to burn for 4.5 million years, so it had to be replenished. How is it replenished? Well, the sun is acting as a comet also. And so anyway, the term that I have been using and coined is excess current of protons. Now, does that mean there's an excess number of protons in the solar wind? No. What it means is that there is an excess current. Current is the charge times the velocity of the charge. So the protons have a higher velocity in the solar wind than the, in fact, when you see a what they call a solar storm or a misnomer, calling it a magnetic storm from standard science, it's really a proton storm. It's a storm of protons, and what's going on is the sun is burning hotter. It's like a fire that all of a sudden, this happens if you're watching, a campfire, and the wood is burning, and all of a sudden it collapses, and then all of a sudden there's a big rush of fire. That's what's going on in the sun, and it's a hydrogen fire. But the end result of this kind of accentuated burning of hydrogen results in a big blast of excess current of protons, not necessarily number of protons, but current of protons. And then also in this, the discovery that you cannot measure the voltage in outer space with a single spacecraft. Very important, and that's what people had been trying to do, and that's why they could not measure. Whenever they measured the solar wind particles, they were always equal. And I talked about that with my debate with Dr. David Morrison on the Coast to Coast show. It comes out clear as a bell that he had no clue. Here's you got your top NASA scientist who does not understand the principle of a voltage measurement with two points, because it's the definition of voltage. And that's just a good example of NASA's top scientists are very, very poor in physics. Something rudimentary like the definition of voltage is a potential difference between two points A and B. And how can you measure that with a single spacecraft? Well, of course, you cannot. And so how do you get around that? Well, you cannot do it with a single spacecraft because it's all connected. And so anyway, there are ways to do it, but I don't want to divert there right now. The Kuiper Belt is a region outside of Pluto that has tremendous number of planets, thousands of them. Now, how come all of these planets are forming out there? Well, it's because that's where the nebular ion cloud is. That's the cloud of material, gas, and dust that's held out there by solar wind pressure. And so because it's also within the solar capacitor, any object out there begins to grow. It has plenty of time, and you can see the comets forming into planets around other star systems. So that's a very important thing. Where did that Kuiper Belt come from? Where did those thousands of planets, some of them potentially Jupiter-sized, out there moving around in orbits around the sun? And that's where they came from. Okay, the induced electric dipole redshift. The bending of light and the redshift, very, very, this is possibly one of the biggest discoveries, most important discoveries that I made in understanding. And this takes off from Einstein's work. This is what Einstein could not get. And he probably would have if he'd have been around long enough to see the space age with the data coming in, etc. Because he was looking at it, he was hunting it, he was bird dogging it, but he died at 1954. And, of course, he had Velikovsky's book, Worlds in Collision, open on his desk. And it was he was trying to understand this issue that ancients had seen electrical phenomenon in the skies. And so he was trying to understand, where's this electricity coming from? It was the same thing I was pursuing. And by the way, when I study all of this, I know the history of physics. I know the big questions that people were. I knew what Einstein was looking for. And I was pursuing the same thing, and I knew where Einstein left off. So I wasn't just walking around in a cloud falling off of a curb someplace with hitting my head on the curb and discovering something by accident. I knew what to look for. I knew what the problems of physics were historically. I knew where other great researchers had left off, and I picked up the path, but with new knowledge, with new information, new data, etc. So the induced electric dipole redshift is a concept I developed, and it explains the bending of light, electromagnetic radiation around stars, and in fact, comets. Comet nuclei exhibit the same thing. There's a redshift that has been measured at the from light leaving the nuclear region around comets. And of course, nobody can explain it because they know the comet is not moving away from us at a high velocity. In fact, in some cases, the comet nucleus was moving towards the observer when they measured a redshift. And of course, it's not due to general relativity and some giant mass. Nope. It's due to the electrical conditions. And once again, that's what Einstein was looking for, the effect on electromagnetic radiation from electric and magnetic fields. And that's why he called into doubt general relativity, which said that bending of light was due to gravity. Okay, next topic, the return August current sheet. Well, being an expert in electronics, and I had taught in electrical engineering in schools, etc., and I had a very good electronics background, my own physics background, etc., whenever you have a current sheet, as you have with the excess current of protons in the solar wind, you cannot keep doing this forever. There's a point at which there's a saturation, which you cannot do it anymore. And when that saturation point hits, even though and you still have protons leaving the sun in greater with a greater current than the electrons, something has to give. There has to be a return current sheet to keep this process going. And so anyway, I said, okay, there has to be a return current sheet. And what are the symbols? What are the things you would look for to indicate where that return current sheet would be? And it's just glaring. It's right in the face. That return current sheet is associated also with the sun being a comet. And that return current sheet happens to be in the where Earth is in the month of August. And, of course, it's going to be accentuated in the plane of the planets. And so, anyway, why do you know it's in the month of August? Because that's the peak aurora month. That's the peak hurricane month. That's the peak tornado month. That's the peak bad weather month. That's the peak when a state like Florida has the majority of lightning, something like 10,000 lightning bolts per day along the eastern Florida border there, and then also places like, because I'd been in the tropics, in the jungles, near the equator, and observing at night. And if you've ever been near the equator at night, you just look up any place, especially if there's elevations nearby, and you see lightning. It's just constant, constant. And it's what some people might call heat lightning. Heat lightning is where you don't have necessarily a lightning strike, but you have the light of the sun. It's almost like an aurora, illuminating. It's like a very faint light bulb that's over on the other side of the hill going on and off, and you just see the atmosphere lighting up. This is the result of the return current sheet, and that builds up the. I'll get to this in a minute when I talk about planets, but when the planets are discharging the solar capacitor, and especially if they have a moon like Jupiter, Earth, Saturn, etc., you get these rings up in the upper ionosphere, which the ionosphere is simply a region where the gases are ionized because of the ultraviolet light from the sun, and it maintains the atmosphere ionized there. And so what happens is there's a segregation because of the magnetic field, and you get, for example, on Earth, you get an electron stream that flows westerly around Earth. And that's because it's in the it's a part of the coupled magnetic field, and it happens on the sun also. And this is related to the solar cycle, the 11-year solar cycle, which is coupled to Jupiter orbit. Jupiter is the dominant planet in the solar system, and it's not a planet. It's a small star. It's discharging the solar capacitor. It's moving in this electric, non-uniform electric field of the sun, and it cycles every 11 years. That's the driving force of the solar cycle. So that's another major discovery that nobody even understood any before, let alone connecting it to some physical causation in the solar system. The nebular ion cloud, I talked about that. And the thing associated with that is the microwave background radiation. So these guys that the COBE satellite, the people that are looking, the Wilsons and the other people who have been studying the microwave background radiation and the anomalies associated with this, don't understand that what they're looking at is simply a cloud that's surrounding our solar system. And why does it have microwaves? Because it's a black body microwave radiation because of this very cool cloud. It's very cool out there, and it gives off about a 3-degree microwave background radiation. This, again, once again, you have Nobel Prizes that were given for the observation of the microwave background radiation, but with the theoretical explanation that it was due to the Big Bang. And that's not true. That's not true. And so when, like I said before, in the 1978 Nobel Prize of Ponzias and Wilson, the discovery of the microwave background radiation, the reason they were looking for it in first place was because of theoretical work based on the Big Bang, saying there should be a remnant of the Big Bang, and not only they hardly had it discovered and measured, then they put up the COBE satellite, which was designed to measure the microwave background radiation in all directions, all in three dimensions in all directions. And what they discovered, it was blotchy. It was not consistent. It was not constant in all directions. In fact, what they secretly discovered and never talked about was it was changing. If you look at the microwave background radiation over time, it is slowly morphing and changing, which should not be the case if it's due to the Big Bang. Okay, and so by the year 2006, they gave another Nobel Prize for the anisotropy of the measurement of the background radiation, because they had to come up with some kind of explanation for why it was not constant. And so that was a 2006 Nobel Prize to put a Band-Aid on the 1978 Nobel Prize and maintain this Big Bang thing alive. Okay, so the main discovery, however, is that the microwave background radiation, my discovery is that it is due to the nebular ion cloud which surrounds the sun and not due to the Big Bang. And that leads up to the next point, is the solar capacitor. The material out in the nebular ion ring, it's more like a donut shape, is ionized because of the light coming from the sun, the ultraviolet light, and it therefore is, and also because of the proton wind, the excess current of protons, creates a positive charged capacitor. That's the anode side of the capacitor, with the sun being the negative side, especially the solar corona, which is magnetically trapped around the sun. And that's another aspect of the sun, is the explanation of why the corona is there. These are high speed, they're basically relativistic electrons in orbit around the sun, which has a positive charge. And so the upper surface of the sun itself is positively charged. Then you have the corona, which has a higher degree, it has higher numbers of electrons in orbit around the nucleus of the sun. And by the way, this is the same thing as ball lightning. The ball lightning is a small fusion-based object. And they're basically what happens a lot of times when ball lightning is formed, it's due to a lightning bolt. What happens is it takes the water molecule, it splits it apart, and you have hydrogen, and the hydrogen breaks off, and then you have ionized hydrogen, so the protons maintain in their relative magnetic fields, holds the protons together, and the electrons as a consortium, I was going to say field, but it's a bad word to use, the electrons orbit the inner positive core, so you have basically a superatom state, and the sun is doing the same thing. And so that explains the solar corona, which nobody could explain previously either. Okay, so I'm going to branch away from the sun. I'll be back on this, but the other part of the solar capacitor is that when a comet or anything comes in between the region, it discharges the solar capacitor, and that is the basis for the plasma discharge comet model. So when something comes in to that region from a distance, and I should also talk about the Oort principle here too. There's an actual observation. I'll bring that up in a minute. But when an object comes into the solar region between the nebular ion cloud and the sun itself, this is a big region. That nebular ion cloud is out about at least twice the distance to the planet Pluto. And yes, Pluto is a planet, along with the other thousands and thousands of Kuiper Belt objects, all of them planets by the very clear definition of the term planet, a comet becoming a planet. But anyway, the discharge of the solar capacitor has all these characteristics. Next thing I will be talking about are the characteristics of comets. And so I'll get into this in a little more detail, but the the object coming into the capacitor. I use the example as of the backyard bug killer as an example that anybody can understand, where you have a ground plate, a screen on the outside. You have a neon light on the inside, which attracts the bug, which would be the equivalent of the comet nucleus, which is just a piece of material. It's not an ice ball. It could have ice. It doesn't have to. And then what happens is it brings the potential in from the region outside, and then it comes into it crosses the gradient of the electric field, non-uniform electric field that's surrounding the sun, and discharges that capacitor. And the discharge is what we call the comet. It has the majority of electrons coming out from the sun. They are the majority charge carrier. That's why the comet nucleus is negative. And this is another absolutely key and important, literally Nobel Prize winning discovery. Why do the comet nuclei charge negatively? And why do they then draw in the positively charged material? And on the small comets, there's not enough gravitational field to hold that material. And so they become neutralized in the electron cloud that is surrounding the nucleus. They're neutralized and they blow out in the solar wind, and they fool astronomers and space scientists into thinking that those are neutrals flowing off of the comet nucleus when they are not. That they are coming in from ionized material coming in towards the nucleus. But what happens with a big nucleus is there's enough gravitational field to hold that material, so the bigger comets grow and grow and grow. And it is the tail drag that causes the comets' orbits to become circularized and eventually fall into circular orbits around the sun. Okay, so very important. One other little aspect here is the plane of the planets. And now we should really talk about the sun and Jupiter, because if you were an alien coming into the solar system for the first time, what you would do is you would look at the sun and Jupiter and the plane of Jupiter's orbit, and that's what you would define as the plane of the planets. But the point here is that in their orbit, say that a comet comes in, it starts to become a planet, it's not in the plane of Jupiter, its orbit is out of the plane of Jupiter's plane. What happens is when it's below the plane of Jupiter's orbit, Jupiter's pulling up on it, and when it's above the plane of Jupiter's orbit, Jupiter's pulling down on it. And so anyway, the end result is that everything eventually works into the plane of Jupiter's orbit. And of course, Jupiter's orbit is adjusting also, because these are pulling on Jupiter. It's Newton's law. Whenever there's an action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And so the plane of Jupiter's orbit is constantly being adjusted also. Okay, and this leads into a whole field of dynamics, orbital dynamics for the capture of comets and how they become placed in the solar system as moons, as planets, and as asteroids, etc. And it turns out that Jupiter was the original twin star pair in the solar system, and all of the other objects were captured at a later date, including Earth. So this idea that the solar system formed all at one time and all the planets were in nice little neat orbits and all the moons were in nice neat little orbits right away is simply not true. And so right here you can see a number of the big principles of standard science. The Big Bang did not happen. The microwave background radiation that they're using some kind of a proof of the Big Bang is not due to the Big Bang, but it's due to this nebular ion cloud that surrounds the sun. Additionally, the red shift that they see in the so-called expanding universe is not due to an expanding universe with things moving away from us. It's due to the induced electric dipole redshift that's causing the red shifts and the bending of light. So when they talk about gravitational lensing, that is not true either. The lensing is due to the non-uniform electric field surrounding quasars and galaxies. And so there is lensing going on, but it's not gravitational. It is electrical and magnetic. Okay, so right away you can see in this discussion the idea that the core fusion of the sun, basic things that had Nobel Prizes hanging on them, have been completely overturned. The Big Bang is completely incorrect. Comets are not dirty snowballs. And the age of the solar system being 4.5 billion years old, these are the axioms of astronomy that I have defined. Those four axioms of astronomy are simply not true right out of the gate. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about comets and the various properties of comets. And in doing so, and by the way, when I go through these discussions, I want to give you what the standard theoretical explanation is also. So let me quick do that for the sun. The standard explanation that has been around since over 100 years is that there is a core of the sun which is hydrogen, primarily hydrogen. And because of the high pressure of the atmosphere bearing down on this central core, it's enough to kick off the fusion reaction. And it's burning, and the heat emanating from that reaction emanates out through the atmosphere. And the prediction was that the solar surface should be absolutely smooth, 6,000 degree orange ball, because that's what it looked like from a distance. But when they started getting instrumentation to where they could actually look at the surface of the sun, the granularization of the sun, it was anything but constant. The holes, the other effects on the sun, showing that the sun, in fact, has all kinds of strange properties. How do the relativistic electrons stay in orbit around the sun? I mean, what's the gravitational explanation for that? Relativistic electrons would go flying off at the speed of light and never come back. There's nothing in the gravitational model to hold them there. So that's a mystery. So they come out with all kinds of goofy explanations like there's a heating mechanism that comes off the sun. And it's so bizarre because it violates the three laws of thermodynamics. You cannot heat something up from something that's cooler in a natural process. Absolutely absurd. So anyway, that's the standard core model of the sun, core fusion model. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't answer any of the questions. It does not tell you where the magnetic fields come from. It does not tell you why there's an 11-year solar cycle. It does not tell you why there's a solar wind or why there's a differential solar wind. It doesn't even know about the differential solar wind. It doesn't tell you where solar storms come from. It doesn't explain anything. And I am out of time. I'll be picking up this topic next week, talking about the other discoveries and all the way through to the second year at Cornell. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.